Hi, you're listening to Wimbledon, hosted by me, Nick Ray. Hi everyone, welcome back to the podcast. I'm very excited today, very excited today because we have a special guest, Richard Gerver from the UK. The reason I'm so excited is most of the people that I've had on the podcast so far are people I've either worked quite closely with or a close friend or my uncle. and this is the first person who is someone who I have actually worked with, but because we hired him as a public speaker, as a professional speaker, to come in and talk to a big group of people, and he was amazing. He's a very talented public speaker, but he's also written books and has an amazing story. And I am so happy that he's come today to talk to us and talk to me and share a bit about his story and a bit about his philosophy around winning as well, because obviously the theme of the podcast is win building. So Richard, welcome to the podcast. Thank you very, very much for coming. And I was wondering if you could just introduce yourself a little bit and a bit about your backstory. Why are you public speaking? Why are you going around the world doing speeches? Tell us a bit about yourself.
Oh, thanks, Nick. First of all, although we might not be related, my mother would be so proud of that introduction. Thank you so much.
Oh, good. Honestly, good.
That was fantastic. So, most of my life has been a series of happy accidents, and for the most part, they've turned out okay. Very quick potted history for people. I actually started out when I left school in the 80s wanting to be a professional actor with dreams of being Olivier. The worst thing that could ever have happened to me happened as an arrogant 18-year-old. I got into rep in London before I left school. So I thought I was going to be the next world's greatest actor, which meant that I didn't go into higher ed or anything. I was just going to go straight into acting. Unfortunately, there was a major flaw in my plan, which was essentially I was rubbish at acting, which was a big issue. Anyway, I did eventually go back to college, much to my mother's relief, I think. She was an incredible, we might touch on this later. She was an amazing mum. And it's only once you've had kids yourself, you realize the courage of a parent to let a child genuinely follow their dreams, right? So anyway, I went back to college. I was studying performance and writing for publication and all the things I was passionate about when I met a young woman and fell in love. She was training to be a teacher. She got me into her school to do drama with her students. And I not only fell in love with her, but fell in love with teaching. It was one of those extraordinary moments, you know, that I don't know how many other people have ever felt this, but I kind of had an epiphany. I walked into her classroom and within half an hour of doing some drama with her kids, I thought to myself, why has this never been part? Why would I never have thought about doing this? And so to cut a much longer story short, I finished my degree, did a postgraduate qualification, qualified as a teacher, ended up as a primary school teacher and then a head teacher for the best part of 20 years as a combination. As a head teacher, took on a failing school. I was very young to be a head teacher. I was just 31. And it wasn't because I was a superstar that I became a head teacher young. It was that love is a theme in my life. So I fell in love with a particular school I was doing some work with. And applied for the job and got it, not because I was a superstar, but because I was the only applicant. The reason I was the only applicant, by the way, was because apparently the school was so bad the government were going to close it down. And the only person who didn't know that was me. The director of education for our local authority told me 15 seconds after I signed my contract. Anyway, that part of my life had a happy ending. I did 7 years and worked with a remarkable community. We turned our school around, going from a failing school to winning a UNESCO World Education Award within 18 months, actually, which was an unbelievable. It's not what you set out to achieve. You just, in any job, right, you set out to do the best you can. And that's what we did. But obviously what that did was change my life. Because all of a sudden we were just a primary school on the cusp of Nottingham Derby in the UK. And all of a sudden everybody wanted to know our secret and our story, which meant because I was the head, I was the one who was most often invited to go and tell people about it at conferences or what have you. And that really grew and grew and grew. And after 7 years of headship, really, I had to make the choice. I remember my wife saying to me, you know, Richard, this is crazy because you're working 7 days a week, 20 hours a day, because you're either trying to do your actual job or you're making up for the time lost doing your actual job because you're traveling and speaking. And by then, I'd got myself a mentor, a man who I've described since as my professional dad. Again, an accidental meeting a few years before. Sadly, he passed away last year, Sir Ken Robinson, who some people might know as having the most watched TED talk in history.
Yeah, and being an amazing guy.
Oh, unbelievable. And I was so lucky that he took me under his wing. But anyway, so I eventually left Grange, my headship, to pursue a career speaking, writing, really initially just around education and education transformation. But what happened very quickly, talk about right place, wrong time. I'd left just before the global financial crisis in 07, 08. And all of a sudden, my life was transformed again because huge corporations weren't necessarily interested as that progressed in the aftermath of listening to the multimillionaire former CEOs talking about making millions and business leadership in the same old, same old. And all of a sudden, this primary school, former primary school head teacher that had led what I hadn't realized was a dramatic turnaround in a very humane and human way, people wanted to know about it. And so all of a sudden, my profile rose. I found myself on the stages working with some of the world's biggest corporations, talking about human leadership and human change. And that, in parallel of doing that over the last 14 or 15 years and writing various books, brings me in a very long-winded way round to how I became a public speaker and what I do now.
I don't think it was long-winded at all. It's perfect. What I mentioned to you before we started, one of the things I've had feedback about is that I assume people listening, watching know what I know about the person I'm talking to. And of course, I've done my homework and I am already excited to talk to them. So I'm very glad to have a bit more of a thorough background update. And yeah, it's amazing. And I think it's an incredible story, but also one of the things, so check Richard out online. He's got about a billion different videos of you on YouTube and things, but some amazing stories. And I think one of the things you talk about a lot is teaching and the impact you can have on young people. And I kind of like to draw back to that before we kind of get more into the winning part or setting up win, or maybe it even just dovetails straight in there. Like, to talk about the school a bit more. What was it that needed to be done? Why was it failing? And what needed to be done to sort of fix it? And I love that you said they wanted to hear our story. Already you're talking about a team, you know, and you were the one that represented that team. But I can understand that, and I hear you saying that. So I'd like you to talk a bit more about that, if you don't
mind.
Sure.
I mean, and I think it's, I think it will hopefully lead into everything else we're going to talk about. You know, so first of all, I walked into this school at the time as a consultant designing, specializing in designing activities to remotivate demotivated boys, actually, in reading and writing. And as I said, fell in love with this place. And it was an interesting organization, amazing school. A lot of the staff had been there all of their careers. And there were three other members of the senior leadership team. And between them, they'd been in that school for 100 years, between them, these three people, right? So it was also right at the heart of its community. For that, people won't necessarily know, but the school was in a place called Long Eaton, which is right on the borders of Derby and Nottingham in the UK, right in the centre, right in the middle of the UK. And Long Eaton is one of those places, and it'll be familiar to anyone listening anywhere in the world, those kind of provincial places where nobody ever leaves. And nobody ever arrives, because unless you've been born there and you've got generations, you're always going to be an outsider, right? A really insular place. Anyway, the school had, I think, about 8 school principals, head teachers in 10 years. There'd been no head teacher, no school principal there for 18 months. The last one had gone off on long-term sick. And it was in this insular place where a lot of the staff either lived there themselves, had spent their entire adult lives there, had had their children and grandchildren go through the place. So the one thing you knew was it was a community that was invested in itself, right? It cared. But the problem was that as the school had declined over a 10-year period, more and more outsiders had come in and told the school what to do, right? So do this, run this strategy, do this. This is the system, this is the structure, this is what you got to do. And of course, every time outsiders came into that very familial but insular environment, it took away, it stripped away a little bit of the personality and the natural state and culture of the school itself, mm-hmm, right? Mm-hmm. So every time that happened, it was undermining further and further away from the truth of the organization. And so I think the reason I fell in love with the place was, despite it being horrendous in terms of data, stats, there were huge numbers of staff absence, kids were being excluded in large numbers, there was an essence of the place that I felt, you know? And that, I think, was about the magnetic draw, that people who arrived stayed, joking apart, that it was a community that was mature in itself. And so for me, the main thing was to say, right, well, what we need to do is stop. And I, you know, I was from a different part of the UK, from a different socioeconomic, you know, I was a middle class Northwest London boy, right? And so actually, who was I to go into this place and tell them what to do? I mean, I knew things needed to change and I had a clear vision of how we were going to do it. But I also knew from the outset, if you go into a strange organization and tell them what to do, you never get proper buy-in. Mm-hmm. You never get full involvement. And people will only ever implement things superficially. And because there had been 8 principals in 10 years, they'd had 8 other people go in there and throw their ideas at the school. So the key for me was to say, right, we're going to strip it all back. Look, we're failing anyway. We're going to be closed. So there's no risk here. Let's just take our time and do what's right for the school, for our children, for our community, not just for what the government say or somebody else's agenda. And of course, you can be courageous in any organization when it's doing that badly and you're new, because there's no vested interest. Right?
So risk.
So exactly. Right. So I said to them, let's strip it all back and forget everything we're meant to do and start fundamentally with the first question, which is, what kind of people do we want our children to be when they leave our school as human beings? And of course, what then happened was, it was like unlocking Pandora's box, because all these people who had suppressed their passion and care and commitment to their community suddenly opened them up again. And the outpouring of conversation was profound. And then the questions flowed from there. So, you know, we had a series of daft ones. I remember once turning around, a really profound one in the end, and saying, how do we turn our school into somewhere as exciting as Disneyland then? How do we create an environment where the kids are so excited to be here that they share the same excitement on a Sunday night as if they were going to Disneyland Paris or Disney World in Orlando or whatever it might be? And the third point then, as we evolved this idea, was, how do we make learning matter to these kids? Not just by telling them that if they get their heads down and do really well, they'll do okay in a test or an exam, but how do you link learning to a development and celebration of life? How do you link learning to creating an environment where young people truly feel they have a chance to develop their aspirations and a sense of value? Because if you bring those things together and you create a learning environment which is rich in context and experience, and it means something, you're going to create an organization which is so deeply rooted in a sense of purpose that the buy-in is hugely more profound than if you're taking on an organization and just telling people they've got to do stuff because they've got to do it.
But did you know this at 31? I mean, that's a lot of wisdom there. And I'm not just, well, I am, I suppose, stroking your ego, but that's a very wise approach. And I think what you're saying about the, you know, going in, I've definitely seen it in my professional career as well. And I agree with you. Obviously, people don't respond well to being told what to do, but it is a huge tendency of management to do that, especially when something's failing, because it's like, well, you know, let's just keep going here. I know what worked in the other place. Where do you think that, I don't know, that confidence or that wisdom? I think it is wisdom.
To trust
because at 30, you said you're 31, I think, when you're there, right?
Yeah.
And to take that on and that approach, I think that's it's obviously fortunate because it worked out, but where do you think that came from? Like what?
Oh God, you know, I wish I could say, yeah, you know, I had the wisdom of Solomon as a 31-year-old. I mean, I often describe now, I mean, first of all, it flows easily from me now, I guess, because, you know, it's a very long time after the event. And, you know, when you've had time to step back and analyze what worked, why it worked, what didn't work, why it didn't work, you sound much more fluent than it was at the time. Look, I went into that job with, I think, two very important and potentially scary characteristics. I was, the two characteristics were ignorance and arrogance, right? I was arrogant enough to believe in my own ability, and I was ignorant enough to have no idea what could happen to us if it all went wrong. And joking apart, I think sometimes, you know, inexperience is not necessarily a bad thing. And the reason I say that is because I think all too often, the older we become, the more experienced we become, the less perversely we trust our instincts, the more we second guess ourselves, the more cynical we become of the situations around us, right? It's like that old adage, the more you have, the more you have to lose, the more you have to lose, the less you're prepared to gamble, right?
Yeah.
And it's so true of organizations that, you know, startups tend to be flexible and dynamic and exciting and innovative because they've got nothing to lose. But the more you have, the more difficult that becomes. And I think that the same thing was true. I took on this organization that was failing. It was going to be shut down. There was nothing to lose. I went in there and I trusted my instincts because I hadn't had years of disappointment or fighting the system in a school leadership role. So for me, it was very much about human instinct. And also the thing about instinct, I think, that people have to remember is it isn't a flight of fancy. You know, instinct is born out of experience. It's born out of your lifetime's experience, and it's in there often subliminally. And I think for me, going into that perfect environment, I'd been a successful teacher always in socially challenging communities. So I guess I'd honed my people skills on some really tough customers, i.e. some kids from really tough backgrounds, right? So leading a group of adults is not that dissimilar because it requires the same kind of skill set. You have to climb inside their heads. You have to understand what makes them tick. What are the blockers? What are the intrinsic motivations? All of those things. And of course, as a teacher, you develop those qualities. Hopefully, if you're a good teacher, you do it naturally. And also, you know, I went into that place with an absolute clarity of belief that I knew what learning should be like and could be like. And I'd never had the mantle of head teacher. So I genuinely didn't carry the burden of an experienced head teacher in terms of it would be brilliant, wouldn't it? But, and I just went in and said, well, let's. The other thing that was really important to me, by the way, was there was wisdom in the school, but it didn't come from me. It came from the aforementioned senior leadership group. You know, when you've got 100 years of combined experience amongst three people that have spent the vast majority of that time in senior leadership, there was a real level of wisdom there. And in a way, one of the important things for me was to get those people on side and to trust me so I could tap into their wisdom. You know, often again, that situation arrives when a new leader comes into an organization. People can go one of two ways. They can become deeply cynical and antagonistic, yeah. Or if you get them right, you can tap into that pack. Because the one thing I knew was that community, those people were passionate about that school. They wouldn't have stayed there that long if they hadn't have been.
Yeah.
So I think for me, I was very lucky in having some real wise heads in that team who could help me challenge me and polish the edges, you know, where they needed to be. But also it was a bit like I don't know if you've ever heard this. I remember hearing this years ago. Vets will often say to the owners of an aging dog, if you can, get a puppy because it'll reinvigorate the aging dog, right? And I think I was the puppy and these aging dogs. So I reinvigorated them and they taught me a little bit of wisdom.
I was going to say, how did you earn that trust? But maybe that was it. They just, oh, what a cute little puppy. Let's play with
it. Yeah, I just wagged my tail a lot. Yeah.
that's awesome. No, but I think it's really interesting to reflect. And obviously, I know you've you know, a lot of your talks and things have centered around this. So you've probably really clarified in your mind how things went and stuff. But I'm interested to know at the time as well, because you said about it was failing and you gave some of the examples of things. And you mentioned kids were getting excluded. And for those that aren't from the UK, that means expelled or kept away from school because they're misbehaving. So that's one of the metrics, I guess, that a school is measured on. But I just wanted to kind of do a little bit deeper on that, because obviously when you were looking at the school and thinking, okay, how do we do this? You know, you had your excellent, you know, question is what kind of people do we want our kids to be? Like philosophy, like let's get the mindset right. You know, how do we make learning matter? Right. Those are very big philosophical questions, which you needed a concrete answer for, I guess, or you needed some concrete strategies for. So combining wisdom of this senior leadership team and this puppy energy, what like, how did you go about that? Because that must have been an enormous challenge. And it's not, you know, it is time constrained. It's not like it's going to be, you had 20 years to work this thing out, right?
Well, yeah, I mean, it's a great question. And in my head, I had mapped out a kind of 5-year development plan. And also, you know, nothing in life is ever wasted, right? And all of a sudden, although I'd had a failed career as an actor, my passion for drama was really powerful in all of this. Because so much of what drama is about tapping into experience and pulling people into an experience and wrapping them in something that feels proactive rather than reactive. And in many ways, that's where we went, you know. So when we'd ask the big questions, and the Disney one, I'll give the Disney one is a perfect example, right? Because I'd asked the Disney one in a staff meeting, one of my early staff meetings, and I'll never forget. And again, all organizations have people like this, not just schools. In every organization, there is what I call the alpha employee, right? Now, they can be male, female, or any gender, right? So it's not specific. But they are that person who thinks they're the boss, even though they're not the boss, if that makes sense. Yeah. They're the one who most staff default to, who are intimidated by, right? In any meeting, everybody looks at them if the leadership challenges people, like, oh, what's she going to say? What's he going to say, right? And I had one in our school who we'll call John, and he happened to be a John, and he was another wizened old member of staff, very unionized. And I remember saying, how do we turn our school into Disneyland? And he went, why would we want our school? Have you ever been to Disneyland? I've been to Disneyland. I bloody hate Disneyland, he said. It's a horrible place, right? Which was really interesting. And I've got to be honest, I was a bit like a deer in the headlights, Nick. I didn't know how to respond to that, really. But bless them, I had this young, newly qualified teacher, fresh in post, right, who'd not been appointed by me, but was a fresh young teacher who still didn't know the rules of the game yet. She didn't understand the politics of the staff room.
Oh, God.
Right? And exactly, right? So it's a destined for trouble. She didn't understand the politics of when alpha speaks, you just all go quiet, right? Because she suddenly piped up and went, how can you say that? I love Disney. My boyfriend and I have just come back from Disney and we've decided we're going to get married there, right? At which point you can only imagine the electricity in this room, right? None of which had been created deliberately by me, but it was fascinating to feel what was then happening. Because then she said this, and this was really interesting. She said, one of the things my boyfriend and I noticed was that when you're at Disney, it's very rarely the children who are having tantrums. It's usually the adults. It's usually the adults moaning about being in a long queue or the price of things or blah, 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 blah. She said the kids are in awe and wonder, even though in many ways the Disney experience is counterintuitive to what kids love, because basically you make them queue for hours on end for a ride that might last 2 or 3 minutes, right? But kids love it and they want to go back. What happened next was fascinating, because somebody else then said, that's a bit like education, isn't it? Education can't all be rainbows and unicorns. And actually, it's bloody hard work, because if you're going to learn, it's a tough thing, because you have to expose yourself to weakness, to a lack of knowledge, to a lack of confidence, to realizing you don't know something or you can't do something. But if you create an environment where kids are prepared to go through the tough stuff because the aura of the place is so powerful, what would that look like in a school? And from that came really interesting conversations about perceptions of ownership, schools being designed around children, not around adults, beginning to understand the pertinent nature of curriculum and meaning, you know, that Disney's storytelling is predicated around familiar tales which children love. Well, you can imagine how all of a sudden the abstract starts to turn into something just a little bit more pragmatic. And from there, you can start to ask for far more real questions about, okay, so how would you make a maths lesson doing fractions more Disney? How would you make a lesson on teaching children paragraphing more Disney? And that became part of our lexicon. And that was really how we started. So that one meeting, that one Disney question taught me so much about the mechanics of how you start with a big question and you then mold that big question into something pragmatic. I think the problem all too often is we are so obsessed with systems and structures that when we've got a challenge or a problem, the default setting is design a system and structure at management level, implement it on everybody else and expect them to do the right thing. And if they're reticent or skeptical, bribe them. Either threaten them with their jobs, make it part of their professional development program or their target setting system, bribe them. And actually the key for us was always, how do we make it matter? How do we make this stuff matter to our primary consumers? And our primary consumers were our children.
Yeah, I can't agree more. And I'm not sure if I mentioned to you, but I've worked in EF for 14 years. It was an education company. And actually the reason we had you talking was, I don't know if you even remember this, but we had the 1200 tour directors, who are the people who accompany young American kids, mainly American and Canadian kids around, mainly Europe, but all over the world. And they're supposed to engage these kids with sort of interesting and delightful educational experiences, along with seeing the Eiffel Tower and things like that. And of course, some of them really got into the idea of that they could engage these kids, and some of them just used tricks to kind of wow moments. And it was a combo. But we were trying, the reason we got you there was to try and inspire them a bit towards these educational ideas and stuff as well. And I think I was always so passionate about, and I'm still, about motivating curiosity. Like, how do you inspire curiosity? And how do you, because ultimately, in my opinion, that's where learning is going to come from. You're not going to learn unless you're curious to learn. And that, I don't know. I'd love to hear your thoughts on that, actually, as a teacher, because that's just something I've kind of come up with over time. But it's really interesting to have approached it from that perspective as well, of how do we get them interested in us? How do we get them interested in this, rather than here's some things we could try to make them interested?
Yeah, I mean, two things, really. The first, you're absolutely right. You know, I remember when I was training to be a teacher, and I don't know where the stat came from or how the lecturer found it, because I've never been able to find it again since, but the sentiment was really powerful. I remember she was talking to us about how we learn. And she said to us in one lecture, you know, we learn somewhere between 70 and 75% of everything we learn in our lifetime before we're five. Now, of course, before people go, well, that's wrong. But I'm not talking about content and knowledge. But if you think about the complexity of what we learn in those first, most of us learn in those first 5 years, right? We learn to walk and talk. We learn to understand vocal intonation, facial expression, body language. We learn to make sense of the sensory world around us. And all of that stuff happens in those first 5 years. We are remarkable learning machines. But as we get older, the rate at which we learn, for all kinds of reasons, diminishes. But one of them I think is because before we're five, we live in a heightened state of being curious, right? And we're not scared of making mistakes. We're not scared of asking stupid questions. We're not worried about looking silly in front of our peer group or anybody else for that matter. And we just ask questions, whatever comes into our head, whatever interests us. And so our learning journey is so profound and so powerful because the world around us is just filled with opportunity. And in so many ways, one of the things I've believed really since then, not just working in education, but in the 14 or 15 years since with high-performing organizations, is if only we could re-engineer ourselves so that we maintained that a level of curiosity, the ability to ask stupid questions. I remember a couple of years ago, I got to interview a man called Barry Barish, who was the 2017 Nobel Prize winner for physics. People can look him up. He's a remarkable mind, a remarkable man. He's in his late 80s now, but many people consider him to be up there with Stephen Hawking as one of the greatest scientists of the modern era. And I remember asking him how he went about recruiting a team of people who go on to win a Nobel Prize. Yeah, I'm fascinated by recruitment. And it's like, how on earth do you put together, it's like the Magnificent Seven or the Avengers. How do you put together
the
a team
super
of people?
Smart.
Yeah, how do you pull these people together? And he said, it's a really good question. And he said, actually, we ended up, when we had 3,500 serious applications, right? I said, what does that mean, a serious? He said, well, these were people with at least two doctorates. These were people who already had global reputations, right, in different fields of physics and science. I said, so how many places did you actually have funding for? He said, well, we were an spectacularly well-funded research project. We had enough funding for it, what turned out in the end to be 138 places. I said, without that's still some trimming. How do you go from 3,500 to... He said, well, there were two caveats. He said the first was nobody made it onto my team if they only had science in their background, because when you're asking people to be innovative or curious, they need a three-dimensionality. And the problem is when you specialize in one field, whatever that field might be, you tend to narrow your vision. And that speaks to what I said before, because as we get older, that happens to all of us. We tend to narrow our field of vision. And so he said, you know, you need people that really have the confidence to look around and ask questions and have come from a diverse range of situations, which he said leads me on to the second question. And the reason I share this is because it's one of my favorite things anyone's ever said to me. He said, nobody made it onto my team. This is a Nobel Prize winning scientist and his team, right? Nobody made it onto my team if they didn't have the ability to ask stupid questions. Now, when you think about that, that is just so pertinent to what you asked me before.
Yeah.
Because that's the killer, right? As we get older, for all kinds of reasons, we stop asking stupid questions. And that's what can be the real difference maker.
Yeah, because the stupid questions are often the ones that help you learn. Like, you have to learn, even if they are a stupid question, it's like, well, then you've learned about it, you know.
You were so right. You know, that thing about curiosity is so important. And the second thing, just very quickly, is what then, of course, tends to happen is as we get older, we're kind of wrongly taught that the currency of clever is to get stuff right, and that we're judged on it personally and professionally. And so what happens is, going back to something we said before, as the stakes rise, as we start to think that we become more and more fearful of making mistakes because somehow we think it exposes weakness or lack of knowledge or intelligence or experience or professionalism, we tend to close our eyes down, right? And we only do the stuff we know we can control and the things we can do. We stop being curious. We stop asking stupid questions. We stop evolving and we stop developing. And I think those are the things we really have to be cognizant of, both in formal education, but also in leadership management and organizational culture.
Mm-hmm. I mean, a big part of my kind of philosophy around building and constructing a win is the fail component. And a lot of the people I've talked to, I think it comes up in every single one, but it's maybe just depending on how you frame the fail. But like, asking the stupid question is often, be prepared to fail. Like, don't be afraid of failing, because that is that is on the route to winning or to succeeding or achieving the something exceptional.
You're absolutely right. And one of the other things on this daft journey I've been on over the last 15 years I've been able to do, privileged enough to be involved in, is working a little bit in elite sports. And I first got involved in elite sports. It was one of those accidental meetings, and somebody from the British Olympic Association came to me and said, you know, we've got a really interesting challenge, Richard, because I don't know if you know this, she said, but some of our most naturally gifted athletes never make it to the highest level. They often drop out early. And she said it'd be a really interesting thing to explore. So I got involved and we started to do some exploration. And I mean, absolutely right. You know, really interestingly, what you tend to see is very young children. You know, there are the ones that potentially could go on and win gold medals or World Cups or whatever else it might be, have an uncanny natural born ability, whether it's a physiology, whether it's psychology, physiology, whatever it is, you know. And you take any sport, but, you know, take a striking sport, a bat and ball sport, for example, right? Very, very young, you can see a child that has an uncanny, natural, God-given talent. They can catch a ball, throw a ball, hit a ball better than anybody else, right? It's just natural. And those kids go on to be the best at sport in their school, in their year, in their group. And they're used to winning. But what then happens, of course, is eventually they get to elite level. They get up to an elite academy. And they've never failed. They've never made a mistake and they've never struggled. So here's the perverse thing. They are so naturally gifted, but suddenly in those elite academies, they come up against other kids who are as good, if not better than they are, right? And for the first time in their lives, they are pushed way out of their comfort zone and they no longer are in control. And the truth is they've never built the resilience. They've never grown the resilience to get to a level where they know they can cope with the failure or the challenge. So most of them suffer quite dramatically and walk away. And, you know, the same thing is not just true in sports. You see it in high-level academics too, and high-level organizations. So a number of kids that, say, go on to Harvard or Yale or Oxford or Cambridge or a top university, you tend to find they're often the ones who struggle most with their mental health problems because they're used to being cleverer than everybody else. And suddenly they're in an environment where they're not anymore and they're not used to struggle. Same thing happens. And the same thing happens in major corporations. You know, organizations that have the pick of the talent pool, the world's most brilliant young people, often top end grads coming out of university. Same thing. You tend to find the one thing you hear those organizations say is we're hiring brilliant people, but they just lack the ability to be entrepreneurial, innovative, take risks and make mistakes. Yeah. And there's the answer. So somewhere along the line, what we've got to do is re-engineer what we perceive to be a fear of failure and start to do a little bit more of what Barry Barish said, which is celebrate stupid questions, because actually that's where the gift of innovation and new comes from. And you're so right. The people that tend to win at anything are actually people that have had to really fight to get there in the first place, because when it comes down to the crunch, that level of resilience, that self-belief isn't carved out of people that have had it easy. It's carved out of people that have struggled and come back and won. And that gives them the confidence when it really hits the fan to know they can deal with anything. And sorry, I hope this is all right, but you know, the whole experience we've been living through, we're recording this, you know, right still in the heart of COVID, right? And one of the interesting things that I think is going to be really interesting to look at over the next decade or so, because everybody at the moment is rightly deeply concerned about the impact of COVID on future generations, young people, lost learning, all of these things. But actually, one of the things that I think is going to be a subtext here is virtually every human being on Earth who survives this is going to come out the end having overcome substantial levels of adversity. Yeah. And actually, that means we may be playing with more self-confidence and resilience in the next 10 to 20 years than any generation maybe before us since the Second World War. And it's going to be very, very interesting to see whether that even subconscious layering and increase of resilience and self-confidence is going to take us into a new renaissance of innovation, creativity, and exploration.
I completely agree. I think it might well do that, and I think it's really interesting to I love thinking about the future because I'm constantly thinking about my little girls and what's their future, and so that's one of my main focuses, and how to set them up right for it. I just wanted to bounce back a little bit into what you were saying, because I think something that ties along with this need for struggle or need for having built resilience through failure or through challenge, through really, really strong challenge and adversity. I that's also where brilliant teaching comes in, or coaching as well. And whenever you meet these high performing athletes or high performing, you know, in whatever field, as you say, whatever field, they are always taking somebody who is challenging them in a constructed way. So the top athletes in the world have a whole host of coaches, but they'll have people who are challenging them to not be complacent, and then challenging them to do things that will make them fail. And I think it's really interesting, because as a teacher, perhaps that's just second nature to you, but I love some of the teachers I've had. Some of them I don't love so much, but some of the teachers I had, you know, they've really hugely positively impacted my life. And I think that is such a key part of where we can do something positive, especially for the young kids of today. You know, I know a lot of teachers complaining about Zoom and complaining about the situation and how difficult it is and things, but I really believe that those that embrace the challenge and help their kids to embrace the challenge, fully acknowledging how difficult it is, fully acknowledging how challenging it can be, and how, you know, how some can really struggle, making sure that the safety net's there to catch them if they're struggling, you know, I think it's a real opportunity, and it's a real opportunity for kids, like you say, but it's also an opportunity for teachers and coaches and people to step up and say, right, okay, yeah, let's move this forward. Let's work out how to help people.
Yeah, I mean, you're absolutely right. And again, you know, every level, right the way through to leading and managing people in organizations, the problem is too often we intervene too soon because we want to protect the people who we're responsible for. You see it in parents, you know, the term helicopter parent. You see it all too often in parents who over intervene in their children's lives because they don't want them to make mistakes. So, you know, it's totally biologically understandable. I don't want my child to be upset. I don't want my child to fall over. I don't want my... But actually, we have to be really careful, right? Because some of that is what helps make us. I mean, I remember having a conversation with my mother. I interviewed her actually for one of my books many years ago when I was writing about change and why some people are better at it than others. And one of the really interesting things that we talked about was my upbringing and the fact that actually I'd experienced a lot of challenge very young and a lot of upset and upheaval. And at the time it was awful. And my mother said, you know, I felt really powerless and went through all those emotions as a mother trying to protect you from so much and knowing I couldn't. And actually what we both realized was, looking back on it, all of those experiences had helped make me. And partly that's because of what you referred to, which she was the constant in my life and my brother's life. And her unconditional love and support was there. So we knew we had the safety net, but she couldn't stop us from experiencing pain and struggle and adversity. And I think that's partly why I'm one of those people who does enjoy change, doesn't get fazed when I'm challenged with stuff. Because somewhere subconsciously and deep down, I know even though it affects me in the moment, I get stressed like anybody else does. There's something inside that says, yeah, but you've lived through tougher. You'll be okay. You'll find a way. And it's that subconscious thing. And I think one of the problems we tend to, as teachers, often we do the same thing for a mix of reasons. One, because we don't want our students to fail or feel failures. Two, because we're under pressure for them to pass tests all the time. So we need them to get stuff right, and we need them to get stuff right quickly, which again is a whole nother topic, but we've got to be very careful about that stuff. And the same thing is then true of being a manager or a leader in an organization. We don't want our staff to feel unhappy or to be dissatisfied or to fail, not just on a personal level, but the stakes can sometimes be really high in an organization. But the truth is, we have to stand back and allow people time to find the solution for themselves. And it's where great coaching comes in, right? Because the job of a great coach is to ask the right questions, provoke the right thinking, when you, again, you go back to elite sport and the holy grail, I think, in elite sport, and it's a really interesting thing to have seen, has been a struggle over the last 30 or 40 years, because has been the move away from traditional coaching. Because in most sports, particularly team sports, actually athletics too, coaches traditionally were basically, their word was law. So what you did as a young athlete, a soccer player, a runner, whatever it is, right? You would do what your coach said. You'd never question it, and you'd just trust they know best, right? What's been really interesting, of course, is people have been looking for the extra millimeter over the last 30 or 40 years, the extra split second, is in the heat of battle, an athlete can't turn to the coach and go, what should I do now?
Yeah.
The athlete has to be able to solve that problem for themselves in a split second, right? Which means they have to have the confidence to self-lead, self-manage and problem solve in split seconds. Yeah, so for years, you know, the level of performance was predetermined by the coach, but then you get to a point where those increments really mattered. And what people, and particularly sports psychologists, when that started to become a thing in the late 70s, early 80s, realized was you needed self-managing athletes. And it was a really interesting struggle right the way through to today, where you see it in different coaching styles, particularly in soccer, where teams often freeze when they're hitting a problem on the pitch they can't deal with, right? And the frustration of a coach. But those players are used to doing what they're told, not thinking through stuff for themselves. And so one of the really interesting things that coaches have had to do is stand back and encourage athletes to solve problems for themselves and not just tell them the answer. Yeah. So for example, an athlete who's running 100 meters, rather than the coach just saying, do this, make your stride pattern this, do that, the coach is now videoing the athlete and going, what do you think? What do you think will give you the... So it's about re-encouraging and re-engineering people to think for themselves rather than relying on somebody else to give them the answer. And to an extent, that's happened in education too, because, you know, all too often we become reliant on our teachers to give us the answer.
Yeah, I'm 100%. I was trying to think of which podcast it was, but I was listening to a podcast with Michael Phelps and Grant Hackett the other day, and I'm trying to think which is a very famous podcaster. But anyway, it's an amazing episode because they go into real detail about those kind of things. They go into detail about a lot of things and how nerdy they were on numbers and stats and everything. But they both talked extensively about their coaching team and how important that was. I think something I am conscious of is that this, you know, this concept of win, how to build a win. People have said to me, you know, what, it's all about sports, right? And I'm like, no, I'm interviewing lots of different people from lots of different things. But obviously winning in sport is very binary. Usually it's very straightforward. And I love having people like yourself on who I think, you know, it's not just about the win of the Grange School having gone from being a failing school to a really top performing school with the UNESCO Education Award. But it's also about that all the interim wins along the way, you know, and the way in which you can construct that theme of how do we be like Disney, or, you know, all of that sort of stuff. And I think it's really interesting to consider the teamwork of building a win, how to get the team together and things. Richard, I'm very, very conscious of your time as well. And I have loved talking to you, but I'm going to wrap up now because I am conscious that I booked you for an hour and our hour is fast coming to an end. Thank you so, so much for joining us. I wanted to give you a chance to promote everything you've got. Tell us where we can find you. Tell us about your books and all of that.
Brilliant. Thank you so much, Nick. So very quickly, first of all, can I apologize because I think my headphones have stopped working. So I don't know if the sound quality's changed, but anyone listening who's got like acute hearing, it's not your ears that are going weird. It's at my end. But anyway, thank you. So let me just give you... So my website, richardgerver.com, loads of stuff on there. They can find my blogs, they can find video footage, they can find news of what I'm up to and all that kind of stuff. And, you know, artsy pictures taken by really clever designers who put together the website for me. You can find me on Twitter at Richard Gerver. Pardon me, and please connect with me there. I love connecting with people. And then my books, I've got four of them. If people are interested in education, my two education books are Creating Tomorrow's Schools Today and Education, a Manifesto for Change. They're all available on the usual online outlets. And then my two more generic books, really about human development and an exploration of who we are and why we do what we do, are called Change, Learn to Love It, Learn to Lead It, which is an exploration around change and why some of us are better than others and what we can do to be better at it. And the other one, Simple Thinking, which is really about why we overcomplicate stuff and an exploration of success. And is it really complicated or not? So, yeah, please get people to connect in any way they can. I'd love to hear from people. And I always promise to reconnect back if anyone makes the effort.
Perfect. Okay, well, please do that, guys, and subscribe to him on YouTube as well. He's got a YouTube channel too. I'll put all the links that I can down below. And thank you again, Richard. It's been absolutely wonderful to talk to you.
Thank you, Nick. It's been an absolute privilege. Thanks so much.